Les colloques du Collège de France.
We'll now listen to our last speaker, Niamh Gordon, whose research focuses on the ethics of violence in Israel-Palestine and attacks on healthcare. After teaching for 17 years at Ben-Gurion University in Israel, Niamh Gordon joined the School of Law at Queen Mary University of London. He's a professor of international humanitarian law and human rights. He's the author of Israel Occupation in 2008 and the co-author with Nicola Pereguini of Human Shield, A History of People in the Line of Fire in 2020. Your presentation is entitled Shields and the Genocide in Gaza. You have the floor for 30 minutes.
Thank you. Thanks everyone for coming today. Thank you, Didier, for organizing it and for my co-panelists. I'm going to talk in the next 30 minutes about a single article in international law. It's the article dealing with human shields, and I think it's going to be one of the key articles in Israel's defense, and it already was in the preliminary hearings, but it seems to me that this will be probably Israel's line of defense. Both the actual use of civilians as human shields and Israel's efforts to frame civilians and civilian structures as shields have played a central role in the application and justification of violence in Gaza, at least since 2008. In following October 7, 2023, Israel has introduced three novel processes related to human shielding. The first involves forcing Palestinian civilians to dress in military uniforms and sending them into underground tunnels as human shields. The second is the casting of practically all civilian structures as shielding structures. And the third includes the invocation of the shielding provisions laid out in international humanitarian law to indict everyone and everything above ground in Gaza as legitimate military targets. Ultimately, all of these different forms of shielding, and most importantly, the accusation of shielding, rather than the actual act of shielding, have become tools for perpetuating genocide and for framing the genocide as legitimate. Before discussing these three processes, let me say a few words about human shields. International law defines human shields as follows: the presence or movement of civilian population or individual civilians shall not be used to render certain points or areas immune from military operation, in particular in attempts to shield military objectives from attacks or to shield, favor, or impede military operations. The use of protected people, such as civilians or prisoners of war, as human shields is, according to international humanitarian law, a war crime. But the legal provision also states that human shields will not render a legitimate military target immune from attack. In other words, it is illegal to use protected people as human shields, but it is not always illegal to kill them. Moreover, since it is illegal to use civilians as human shield, a warring party that kills human shields can assign the blame and legal responsibility for the shields' deaths on the party using them as shields. If I force a civilian to be a shield, and someone from the audience here kills them, I am to blame for the death rather than the person that killed them. The underlying logic here is that the illegal use of civilians as shields put in motion the interactions that led to their death, and that the bullet or bomb that killed them was merely an effect of their original illegal use as human shields. And thus, the blame is placed on the original illegal action. This is a crucial point, since it suggests that human shielding charge or the human shielding accusation can be used not only to assign blame on a warring party for committing a crime of using human shield, but also to exonerate the warring party that is actually killing civilians. Another important point is that when thinking of human shields, Nicola Perugini and I have highlighted the difference between animate and inanimate shields. Human shields function as defensive tools, but in a profoundly different way from inanimate shields, such as landmines used to defend a border or anti-aircraft missiles protecting an airfield. Human beings would seem an unlikely choice for a shield, since as embodied beings made of flesh and blood, they can be easily killed. A human body becomes a shield by virtue of its vulnerability, whereby the vulnerability associated with civilianhood aims to produce moral deterrence on the part of the opponent. The distinction between the two types of shields appears in an infographic that Israel circulated in 2014. Hamas protects its weapons with human shields has been used to lay claim to a civilizational divide between the civilized Israelis and the barbaric Palestinians, and to intimate that Palestinian civilians are killed in large numbers because Hamas uses them as human shields. But the infographic also underscores the distinction between animate and inanimate shields. As opposed to the inanimate shield, which is ultimately conceived and produced to protect human vulnerability in war, in the case of human shields, vulnerability itself becomes the means of protection. George Wesley Bellow's 1918 painting entitled The Barricade, informed by the German use of human shields in Belgium at the beginning of World War I, seems to intimate that when faced with vulnerable shields, a certain moral obligation is meant to emerge, and this obligation is meant to dissuade or deter belligerents from attacking a target defending by such shields. It is this sense that human shielding is fundamentally a politics of vulnerability. In our book, Human Shields, A History of People in the Line of Fire, Perugini and I went on to claim that the history of human shields is inextricable from the history of the human. We showed, for example, how the racialization of human shields changed over time, laying bare how in the past only whites could become human shield because only they were considered to be fully human and could be cast as civilians deserving protections. So in one of our chapters, we look at the American Civil War and at the siege of Charleston. And Charleston was a city in the South that was majority black, and of course had many women and children, but the only people that were understood to be human shields in the exchange between the general inside Charleston and the general outside were the military officers that were captured from the north and brought and situated in houses inside Charleston to defend them from attack. So it was only white officers that were human shields. Now, We tied this observation to claims made by Anthony Angi, Frederic Magritte, and others explaining that non-white civilians in the colonies could be killed during armed conflict without it being a crime. It was only after decolonization, when the ex-colonized were admitted to the family of nations, and as members of this family were endowed with a series of legal protections, that non-white civilians could become human shields. Our empirical analysis shows, however, that following decolonization, Western militaries began casting non-white civilians whom it had killed as human shields, regardless of whether they were actually shields. If one were to color a map of the world using darker shades for countries where accusations of human shielding have been most prevalent since the Second World War, then ex-colonies such as Afghanistan, Iraq, Lebanon, the Palestinian territories, Sri Lanka, Syria, Vietnam, and Yemen would certainly have the darkest contours. One way many legal and military experts account for the concentration of shielding accusations in these countries is by pointing out that human shields are deployed at higher rates in asymmetric armed conflict between powerful high-tech militaries and irregular fighters as the preferred weapon of the weak. According to the experts, rebels and terrorists in the global south, where most ex-colonies are located, are increasingly using human shields to protect themselves from cutting-edge military technologies and new weaponry. However, our historical reconstruction of human shielding suggests that the story is more complex than that, not least because the darker shades on the proposed map correspond to darker-skinned populations. The fact that practically all invocations of shielding are connected to non-white civilians in ex-colonies exposes how the figure of the racialized colonial subject and the human shield are inextricably linked. Hence, another way to interpret the map is that shielding accusations by the strong function as a pushback against the integration of the ex-colonized people into the international legal order and as a tool of high-tech militaries to justify the killing of large number of civilians in the former colonies. In the book, we went on to show that the effort to frame civilians as shields has become increasingly widespread after the U.S. launched its war on terror. I have much more to say about human shielding, but let's move back to Gaza. Let's begin with dressing Palestinians in IDF uniforms. Al Jazeera and later Haaretz have reported how Israeli troops abducted Palestinian civilians, dressed them in military uniforms, attached a camera to their bodies, and sent them into underground tunnels as well as into buildings in order to shield Israeli troops from enemy fire. To be sure, Israel's use of human shields is not new. However, Palestinians who were used as shields in previous rounds of violence always wore civilian clothes and could thus be identified as civilians. Again, the visibility of their civilian status is meant to deter Palestinian fighters from attacking or firing, and it is central to the constitutive logic of human shielding as traditionally understood. It is precisely the recognition of vulnerability and that they are fellow Palestinians which are key to the purported effectiveness of human shielding and for deterrence to have a chance of working. But randomly kidnapping Palestinian civilians, including youth and the elderly, and then dressing them in military garb before forcing them to walk in front of soldiers, the Israeli troops violate not only the legal provision against the use of human shields, but also the provision that deals with perfidy and prohibits warring parties from making use of military uniforms for adverse parties while engaging in attacks or in order to shield, favor, or protect, impede military operations. So here we see two war crimes in a single action. Yet the perfidy dramatically alters the logic of human shielding. Instead of highlighting the vulnerability of Palestinian civilians, the Israeli military purposefully conceals their vulnerability. Israeli troops deploy them as shields not to deter Palestinian fighters from striking the soldier, but rather to draw fire and thus reveal these fighters' location, allowing the Israeli troops to launch a counterattack and kill the fighters. The treatment of Palestinian civilians in this manner provides a clear indication of the relationship Aimé Césaire draws between colonialism and the thingification of the colonized. It reveals how the military operationalizes ex-defense minister Yoav Gallant's racist assertion that we are fighting human animals, exposing how for the Israeli soldiers, Palestinians are either animals, prey, or bait, animal or bare flesh. Like hunters who use raw material to lure animals they want to capture or kill, the Israeli troops use Palestinian civilians as if they were bare flesh whose function is to attract the hunter's prey. Palestinian civilians become a thing when they are transformed into bare flesh. But to be transformed into bare flesh, they have had to have already undergone processes of racialization that constitute them as non-human. Such racialization explains why for Israeli Jews, the Palestinian expulsion from humanity appears to be both deserved and natural. Instead of using Palestinian civilians as human shields, Israel's new practice transforms them into inanimate or bare shields. Before turning to the second difference that we have witnessed in Gaza, the casting of practically all civilian structures above ground as shielding structures, we need to make a brief detour in order to discuss how international humanitarian law defines legitimate targets. When one says human shields, most people think of humans who either volunteer, like Rachel Corey, or forced into becoming human shields, like the Palestinian in this image. The International Committee of the Red Cross claims, for example, that the term human shields describes a method of warfare where the presence of civilians or the movement of the civilian population, whether voluntary or involuntary, is used in order to shield military objectives from attack or to shield, favor, or impede military operations. Notwithstanding this description, the notion of shielding in international humanitarian law is actually much broader and does not only apply to humans. Perugini and I examined, for example, attacks on hospitals in war zones, described how they were used and framed as shields. Even though we also mentioned charges of shielding leveled against schools and mosques, we failed to indicate and fully develop the significance of the fact that the shielding accusation can extend well beyond the human to include any legally protected, namely civilian, inanimate object. International humanitarian law provides protection to civilians and civilian structures where this is not justified by military necessity. The legal protections do not apply where a civilian site is used for military purposes and its destruction offers a warring party a definite military advantage. At such point, the civilian site becomes a military object, which is a broad and fluid term that is difficult to define, but casts that which it names as a legitimate military target. In short, according to international humanitarian law, any structure that has a military function can be legitimately targeted, while structures that have a civilian function cannot. Yet a structure that has a civilian function can assume a military function. And once this occurs, that structure can be legitimately targeted, provided certain principles are taken into account. International humanitarian law, in other words, recognizes that objects might have a dual use, and when they do, the military function usually trumps the civilian one. While civilian sites and structures can be transformed into military objects in different ways, the most prevalent one is when they are framed as shields, because combatants are allegedly hiding within the civilian site or using the civilian site to hide weapons. The militarization of civilian objects has become increasingly widespread due to the urbanization of warfare, the transformation of urban spaces into battlefields, alongside the vast asymmetry of many current conflicts. Michael Schmidt, who is a conservative international lawyer, underscores the difficulty of distinguishing between civilians and combatants in contemporary wars, explaining how during US invasion of Afghanistan, guerrilla groups were scattered and, I quote, wore no uniforms or distinctive clothing that allowed immediate visual identification, and the mere position of a group, vehicle, or other mobile target seldom served as a reliable indicator of what its enemy character. Accordingly, determining what a person does rather than how a person looks is now considered vital for understanding what a person is. And in a similar way, detecting how a building is used determines whether to classify it as a military or civilian object. And this is another infographic produced, I think, in 2012 or 14 by the IDF to show that apartment buildings are actually military bases. The increasing significance of detecting persons and structures' function in battle spaces, particularly in urban settings, emphasizes the vital role currently played in by the military gaze, which is manufactured and meditated through the interactions among different technologies and forms of intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance. There is a growing scholarly literature that analyzes the embedded racial biases shaping surveillance technologies and the way people see more generally. Here, it is important to stress that the process of racialization informed the military gaze and helped shape the perceived function of civilians, but also of civilian structures. The military gaze is increasingly dependent on algorithms that are structured by social norms, an extremely troubling development, which I can't discuss here, but had horrific consequences in Gaza. In my research in several theaters of political violence, I've shown how the military gaze frames civilian sites and structures shields in order to justify striking them. In Gaza, however, the shielding charge has been summoned to indict an unparalleled number of structures. Already in January 2024, just 3 months after Israel's attack began, the BBC reported that between 144,000 and 175,000 buildings across the whole Gaza Strip had been damaged or destroyed, amounting to 60% of all civilian structures in Gaza. 20 months into Israel's genocidal campaign, Israeli forces had completely or partially destroyed 89% of the buildings in Rafah, 84% of the buildings in the northern Gaza Strip, and 78% of the buildings in Gaza Strip, and that was before the in Gaza City, but that was before the invasion of the city itself. My claim is that even before the military function is attributed to a civilian structure and its signification is modified from a civilian to a dual use structure that can be legitimately attacked, the structure itself undergoes a process of racialization, which is vital for rendering the dual use charge believable among certain publics. The point is that settler colonial racism shapes the way soldiers interpret not only the function of Palestinian civilians, but also the function of Palestinian civilian structures. So we witness how the colonized human being becomes a thing under colonialism, while the thing is ascribed a bio, as if it is part of a human organism. The notion that space and the structures within it are racialized is not new to scholars of settler colonialism, since the inanimate structures are also subsumed under what Patrick Wolfe has called the organizing grammar of race. And indeed, a plethora of studies have shown that one of the prime objectives of every Israeli government since Israel's establishment in 1948 has been to Judaize the space it controls. In reality, this has meant the destruction of Palestinian space and its reproduction as Jewish. How has this played out in Gaza? This is not working. Consider, for instance, the following assertion made by Israel's Ministry of Foreign Affairs. The ministry spokesperson has maintained that the mere fact that seeming civilians or civilian objects have been targeted does not mean that an attack was unlawful. The term seeming is, of course, key here. The argument is that Palestinians' homes might seem to be homes, hospitals might seem to be hospitals, mosques might seem to be mosques, schools might seem to be schools, but Israel's military gaze reveals that in Gaza, they are not what they seem. Instead, the military gaze exposes that each home is actually a hideout. Hospitals serve as arms depots. Mosques conceal tunnel piers, and schools shield rocket launch platforms. To be sure, there may have been cases when civilians and civilian objects have been used in Gaza for military purposes, but Israel has indicted hundreds of thousands of his civilian structures. During the first 3 months of its campaign, Israel killed more civilians and destroyed more civilian sites than Assad's regime had done in Aleppo over several years of fighting, and more than the Russian forces did in Ukraine in 3 years. Proportionally, it wreaked more damage than the Allied bombing of Germany in World War II. As Israel killed thousands of civilians, it also destroyed Gaza's civilian infrastructures. Hospitals, clinics, houses, apartment buildings, power plants, electricity grids, water sanitation infrastructures, schools, universities, libraries, archives, mosques, churches, agricultural lands, greenhouses, and fishing vessels were all targeted. To justify its attacks, Israel has claimed that Hamas intermingles with the civilian population, using them as shields, and that the militant group has also built what are believed to be hundreds of kilometers of underground tunnels beneath Gaza, and since these tunnels are a legitimate military target, the Israeli team has invoked international law to claim that all civilian objects and every single civilian situated on Gaza's land surface are potential human shields and are therefore not immune from attack. And since Palestinian and civilian structures become shields due to their location above the tunnels or near fighters rather than due to some actions they or Palestinian fighters are carrying out, they can be characterized as shields for as long as the fighting persists. There is no agency needed here. Finally, we can turn to my third claim involving the scale of the shielding accusation and its impact on the international legal order. Israel's interpretation of the laws of war serves its genocidal war. The country's legal military thinking has progressively developed over the past two decades and has now succeeded in transforming all civilian and civilian objects into targets in a way that perfectly aligns with the statements made by Israeli political and military leaders, and particularly the notorious claim that there are no uninvolved civilians in Gaza. Legally speaking, the moment Israel invokes the Geneva Conventions to frame everything in proximity to Hamas fighters or above the tunnels as a legitimate military target, the law itself is operationalized as a tool of genocide. Israel has, for instance, targeted health facilities in Gaza over 800 times, systematically striking 33 hospitals and scores of clinics and ambulances, often multiple times. Before and after each attack, it invoked the shielding provision to justify the assault. Similarly, almost every time Israel kills civilians, it casts them as human shields. The seemingly endless multiplication of the human shielding accusation and its extension to the entirety of Gaza reveals how easily shielding can be invoked in a way that abolishes the figure of the civilian and consequently any possibility for civilians to take shelter and be spared from the fury of annihilation. Israel's invocation of the human shielding provisions not only reveals some of the limits and biases informing the structures of the international legal order, but also threatens the very architecture of this order, which following World War II was developed as part of an effort to bolster the vision and resolution of a never again. If the post-World War II Geneva Conventions can be invoked, as Israel does, to legalize acts which can destroy a people in whole or in part, then the international rule-based order that was created to regulate war according to humanitarian principles becomes the tool for undoing that very order. Indeed, Israel mobilizes the Geneva Conventions to undermine the Geneva Conventions and the institutions that support them. Its tool of choice is the figure of the human shield. Thank you very much.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.